You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week we celebrate the work of volunteers by going weeding in Tasmania, discover how easy it is to build a worm farm, and try and spot a platypus in the wild. We'll also hear the heartwarming story of Beverly Pedrosini, who's bought back the family property she lived in as a child.
I almost cried when I walked into the house at Presswood because the beds are still in the same position as they were when my father and I used to sleep on the veranda in the main house. I'm going to try and preserve it again now because it has been neglected. I want to try and bring it back to what it was.
Buying back Presswood later in the program. But let's start today's travels by pulling on some heavy-duty gloves and getting in amongst the weeds on Mariah Island.
Every year across Australia, tens of thousands of people give up their time to battle weeds and other invasive threats to the environment, like these volunteers with Drive Galore. We're on Mariah Island, just off Tasmania's east coast, where volunteers are stopping a serious invasion of a weed called canary broom. I'm Rose Grant, and I've joined the Wildcare Friends of Mariah Island Sweeping the Broom Eradication Team, who've almost achieved that goal. But don't be fooled by these cheerful voices. These volunteer weeders go bravely where no one on a wage would go.
I love coming out into the bush. I love the company and I love doing the exercise. To me, it's an escape from everyday routines at home. It's just a beautiful place to work.
Relatively.
Well, yeah, because down the bottom anyway was beautiful thick soil. And we took it
oh,
down.
Okay.
And how many times have I been here? About three, four? Quite a few, yes.
I'm Sally Salia, a Wildcare volunteer.
And what brings you back?
I think because I am a weed tragic, a weedaholic. I guess for years I was a bushwalker and enjoyed the environment greatly. I've got a great deal from it. In my older years, I don't feel like carrying a heavy pack for days on end. I can still be out in nature and I can still be of a great deal of use, helping the environment and getting my exercise and still being in nature.
Qualities of a volunteer, Matthew?
Qualities of a volunteer. Some people you never see again. They come on one working bee and that's the last you ever see of them because you've got to be prepared to work during the day together as a team. So that sort of cooperation helps to keep you going because it's quite hard work pulling out broom in the bush. It's not easy work.
So what brings you back?
Brings me back is, I think, meeting some of the regular volunteers, maybe meeting new volunteers. I feel as though I'm doing something for the environment. Many things you can't do individually, and this is one way of sort of contributing to the environment, I guess, and to the community.
It's right out on the point, at Fisher's Point.
Where are we? We're looking at the map.
Yes, this is Benaki's Valley on Mariah Island. We're working on the largest known site of broom, which is probably the last site we have to do.
But it is interesting, isn't it, just the way it's spread?
Oh, it's incredible, and we think it's a very early introduction to the island, planted around Darlington, and then carried perhaps by boots and up the track to Bishop and Clark. And once it gets established, of course, the animals take the seed off the plant, or the flowers, and it goes through their gut and spreads right down into the valley.
So it's delicious to the native animals. What sort of plant is it?
It's Genista monpetulana, one of the broom family. There are quite a lot of broom weeds in Tasmania, but this is the only one we have here, and there have been numerous attempts to try and contain it. But it all started with a ranger in 2007 who decided to get contractors in, and to do that we needed mapping done. So we started mapping the broom, not really knowing where it was. And this was all done by volunteers, basically.
And you're one of the volunteers, Anne Booth. What had you think
Yes, we can do this. Because just looking at this map, as you say, it's been everywhere.
Well, it has, but I don't think we ever imagined clearing it. It was always, we'll try and contain it. And that was the main thing. And the initial concern was having it along the track where people saw it and they thought, oh, it looks awful. So that's where we started. People saw it up the valley and they thought, this is not good in a national park. We just kept weeding ourselves in the isolated patches and following up on the contractor's work.
So how many in this volunteering group have you got this week working on this patch?
We've got 11. We clear a lot of weeds with 11 people.
Well, I'm looking at this map and I can see that it's been 11 times how many working bees over the years?
Our first official working bee on this one, 2005, we've had about 25 working bees. But those early ones, it was just the weekend. Arriving Saturday morning, leaving Sunday afternoon. We thought, well, we won't get very far with those hours. So we've made it into 4 days at a time.
And I'm really glad I've come on this trip because there's only one little patch of red. All the primary control is going to be done.
Once we've done that. That's the known weed, yes. That's in Pinaki's Valley. And we never thought we could get to it because the vegetation's so rough. But having found this route up the creek and then 80 metres up the slope, it's been quite accessible. Because it's not accessible to contractors, really. And not sprayable because it's such mixed native vegetation.
And Ruth, when you say the territory's so rough with a smile in your voice, I should ask some of your other volunteers here. Terry, you're a first timer.
I am, yes. Yep.
Tell me about the conditions.
Interesting. It's a learning process.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen you down on your hands and knees.
I've found some very interesting bugs and snails. These are the things your feet are banging on and you don't notice because you're so busy looking ahead or looking up in the trees if you're a birdo like Phil and myself are. But getting down there and you're really seeing stuff in detail. No harm in that. It's part of the experience. And the company means a heck of a lot. It's really good. The conversation doesn't stop while they're working. It's ongoing, echoing through the bush. No, it's been an eye-opener and really enjoyable experience. And I'd just recommend it to anybody, really. Just seeing something a bit different than what you would do on the normal touristy routes.
Good morning. So, yes, my name is Karen Montgomery. I'm a horticulturalist, nature lover, and the thing I'm really passionate about is growing food.
There's a pile of foam boxes in the corner, some soil, coconut fibre and shredded paper, the ingredients you need to make the perfect worm farm. And horticulturalist Karen Montgomery is here to show us how it's done. Hello, I'm Lauren Waltheater in the town of Gladstone in the mid-north of South Australia, where about 25 keen gardeners have gathered to learn how they can turn their kitchen scraps into a rich fertiliser.
I'll do any kind of workshop around gardening. Really like to talk to people about ways to recycle, reuse, to grow organically, and my passion is growing edibles. Luckily enough, I've been coming up for a week every month for the last few months, and I'll be back again in the Southern Flinders area in early next year, so loving it.
What's so good about worms?
They're amazing. I don't know what's so good about worms. They do this job for us. They recycle. They make it so easy for us. We have a lot of food in this country. We're very blessed to have a good variety of foods that we can have access to, and we end up with scraps. And so to be able to put these scraps into a box and have worms turn them into free fertiliser for us, it's just really, you know, no nonsense, easy thing that everyone can do.
So what do you think? You're ready to make a worm farm?
Yep.
Okay, so the idea...
She tells us there are a number of ways to make a worm farm, but today we're going to use the box system.
And I use a three-box system. We're going to make a two-box system today, but I'm going to explain to you how to make that third box, and then it's up to you if you'd like to go and scout around a fruit and veg shop or something and get yourself another polystyrene box, and you can do the three tiers. So the ingredients for making our worm farm are a handful of soil, small handful of soil, a handful of coir, coconut fibre to hold moisture, some shredded paper, and the worms, and we'll cover them all up with a hessian blanket.
Everyone is given two styrofoam boxes and told to stab holes in the bottom of the second one.
See, you're stabbing it very methodically almost, whereas yours is a bit random. I wonder if that makes a difference.
I don't know, but what it says an awful lot about my mind. I'm an accountant.
That's Kay Matthews, a gardener from Laura. I asked her why she wanted to learn more about worm farms.
I'm a fairly keen gardener and I've got quite a lot of compost piles, but I just wanted the worm farms because they give you a better solution for your veggies. I try to grow a lot of vegetables.
In the mid-north up here, it's sometimes a bit difficult, I'd imagine, to grow veggies. How do you go?
I go reasonably well, actually. Just got to be careful that you don't plant them out too early because of the frosts, and you need to make covers, you know, because we get really hot weather.
Are you happy with how your worm farm's turned out? It looks quite good. It's a two-storey structure here. Are you happy with that?
Absolutely. I can't believe how easy it was. I've just got to make sure I can find a cool spot at home where it doesn't get any sun.
Do you want some water?
Shortly after, people begin to leave with their worm farms in hand. They all seem slightly surprised by how easy the whole process was. Here's Karen Montgomery again.
As humans, we complicate everything. We just make things so hard for ourselves. And when we go along and we put a handful of soil, a handful of worms, a handful of coconut fibre, some shredded paper if we have it, and cover them up with a blanket, everyone always says, "Oh, is that all we have to do?" And that's it. Give them some food and put them somewhere cold and dark and moist, and you're a worm farmer.
Up here there are a few unique challenges because it is dry in summer, but it's also cold in the winter. So how can the things that you're talking about help, I guess, amateur gardeners, as most of the people here today are?
Yeah, so we talk a lot about water usage and we talk about wicking bed systems and different ways of holding moisture in the soil by using things like the coconut fibre today that we use in pots, especially if you're growing in pots or in the worm farms. Lots of different little clues that can help them out.
Horticulturalist Karen Montgomery showing how easy it is to get a worm farm up and working. Still to come on Rural Reporter, Beverly Petrosini returns to her family home and Skye Manson goes in search of a platypus in the wild.
This is the best spot here. You can see them, you know, from a fair distance away. Normally I'll come out around and get set for him to come in where he needs to and take a few photos. So, yeah, this is by far the best spot in the creek.
I have to admit to you that I am a little bit excited this morning. I'm sitting on the edge of the creek waiting patiently for my very first glimpse of platypus in the wild. And apparently, my chances of seeing this extremely shy mammal is pretty good if you ask local farmer Mick Fitzgerald. Hello, I'm Skye Manson and I'm at Molong in the central west of New South Wales. This creek that we sit by has been the subject of extensive environmental work from the local Catchment Management Authority, the Cabon Shire Council, and also farmers who have absolutely transformed this waterway in recent years. Gone are all those awful blackberries and invasive wattle trees, and they've been replaced with a really, really pristine creek and clear water, which is just right for platypus spotting. Now, Mick, you and I have been sitting here for quite a while now, and unfortunately there hasn't been any sign of the elusive little platypus yet.
No, you can come down here the same time every morning and you can see them for day after day, and then you can come down the same time a week later and you won't see them. It just, yeah, I don't know whether they have a regime, but it can be either early in the morning or late of an afternoon. It doesn't really matter.
What do I need to be looking for?
It's a little bit windy today, but normally if you sit here like we are, you can just see a little bit of a ripple on the water when they come up out of the water after foraging, and they'll just poddle along like a duck. And you'll see the ripples on the water, and normally I'll just walk down along a little bit and he'll duck under the water for a sec, pop up, have a look at what's going on and see that they're not going to be harmed, and they just continue doing what they do.
Well, we'll keep sitting here for a little while just to see whether we can see them or not. I'd love to be able to. But in the meantime, I mean, I've never seen a platypus in the wild, and I think that is something that I share with most of the population. But you've got not one platypus here, but three of them.
Yeah, there's three down along here. I've seen them all three on the same day, so I know there's three different ones here. Everyone seems to think that they're very hard to come by, but from what I understand, they're a little bit hard to find, but they're quite plentiful along the creek.
Part of the reason why the platter pie are here is because of the habitat of this creek. Were we sitting here 3 years ago, what would the creek have looked like?
Look, the creek was overgrown with blackberries.
We would have been sitting in a blackberry bush.
We would have been sitting in a blackberry bush. You wouldn't have got near the creek. When we first had a look at buying here, we couldn't actually get near the creek for the blackberries, but now it's cleaned up. Council have come through here, got rid of the saxias out of here. The saxias are the terrible willows that clog up the creek. Now it's so pristine, it just reminds me of, you know, when I was a child fishing for trout.
For people who are not lucky enough to be sitting here with us this morning, how is it pristine? Paint me a picture. What does it look like?
Oh, look, it's flowing. Years ago, it used to stop flowing. I understand that the saxias, when they're mature, take enough water out that would fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool per year. So if you imagine you had hundreds and hundreds along here, the creek would be, the water would be soaked up from the saxias. The saxias are gone. The creek, I've never seen it flow any less than this. We've had a couple of dry times in the last few years. Like, the clarity of the water here is probably as good as what you'd see, but it's absolutely magnificent, and it just looks a little bit like paradise if you owned the place.
Now, I haven't forgot the main reason why we're here, and that's hopefully to see a platypus this morning. I keep hoping that while you're talking, I'll look over your shoulder and we might see one flowing through the water, but...
As I say, you just got to be lucky. I can come down here any time of the day and, look, I'm not quite sure of their regime, but you can be lucky or you can be unlucky. It just depends on the time of the day and it just depends on what they're doing, I guess.
Well, we can have a little bit of a walk downstream and see how we go, but I don't think today's our day, Mick.
No, it's probably a little bit windy. It's good if it's not blowing and you can sort of sit along the stretch. As I say, it's about 400 metres long. You can see a lot of it. You just see a little ripple in the water every now and again and just wander on down and they'll be just poddling around the base of the river. So, yeah, we'll walk down and we'll see if we can see one.
Have you got names for them?
No.
I'll name them.
You will? Yeah? Okay, no.
I'll be back again, I think.
No worries, Skye. Not a problem at all.
I almost cried when I walked into the house at Presswood because the beds are still in the same position as they were when my father and I used to sleep on the veranda in the main house. The house is still as I remember it. I'm going to try and preserve it again now because it has been neglected. I want to try and bring it back to what it was.
So often we hear about the family farm being sold off, but this is a story about the family farm being bought back. Hello, I'm Charlie McKillop on Presswood Station, just to the west of Georgetown in far north Queensland. It's here that Beverly Pedrosini, once Green, spent much of her childhood, growing up on a property owned by her aunt Jane Bedser. And when she became too old to manage it, Presswood was sold off and lost to the family. But earlier this year, when it came back on the market, for Beverly it was an opportunity to bring it back to the family.
Oh, the homestead was always a friendly place. Used to have to measure the rain, or it was also an exchange for the telephone. But what's disappointed me most is that all the records of the rain for over 100 years has gone from Presswood, sort of history of the place.
Beverly Pedrosini, what else do you recognise when you look around the property today?
Where I'm standing now is the water used to be pumped up here to water the mango trees, and we used to play in them as a swimming pool. The river was one of the great things because I'm a real water person. And Daisy, the dark lady that used to be here with the Greens, used to take us fishing nearly every Sunday. She showed us how goannas dug holes and how to catch them if we really wanted to catch one, and how to catch fish if we didn't have a proper line and whatever.
How much time did you spend with Daisy?
Oh, all the time I was with her. She taught us how to make bread, and when the mangoes were in season, we'd cut up mangoes to make mango jam, and the fruit trees that was here, we'd make all our own jams and preserves.
Was it a happy childhood?
I think it was sort of a little bit hard, but In those days, you had to respect your elders, and what their rules were, you had to abide by them. Yeah.
What went into the decision to come back here? Because obviously properties don't come onto the market all that often in the Etheridge Shire.
We've always sort of wanted Prestwood, but when my aunt first sold it, well, we weren't in the position to buy. The next time we weren't in the position to buy, but this time we were in the position to buy it and try and keep it in the family. I've got a lot of old photos of different families, like Tonks Camp wasn't far away. Well, that's where my other great-grandparents come from. So, you know, the Gilbert River has a lot of my family history behind it.
Tell me about your aunt, Jane. Was it Jane Green?
Yeah, she was Jane Bedser. She married, but they never had any children. But she lived here and she ran the place, and she was a magnificent worker. They had a dairy here too, across the river.
So you had your own milk here?
Yeah, they had their own milk. They made milk and butter and some sort of cheese. I can't remember the name of the cheese, and I can't remember the name of the dairy, but it was a place where they come from in England. The jars that the butter was made in was given to the Etheridge Shire Council to put into their library or museum, so I don't know whether the jars are still there. I'll take you and show you the house. Seeing it's over 113 years old, I think you'll be surprised. I don't know how true it is, but I was told that it was moved from Croydon to here. How they would have done it, I do not know. But I'm trying to investigate so that I can put a bit of a history together of the house.
Let's go and have a look. So you reckon these mango trees would be as old as the property?
Yeah, I'd say they would have been planted here when they had the old tin house, the corrugated iron house here. My grandmother died 3 weeks before I was born. So, yeah.
So you missed out on a lot of those stories.
Yep, this is the kitchen here where the table that's here now is not as long as it used to be. But we made all the bread and cakes and preserves. And
right here in this kitchen?
Right here in this kitchen.
Oh, wow, look at the veranda.
This is where they had the telephone exchange. And there was a big long table here, and this is where we ate. This was their lounge room, but this was preserved for my auntie and uncle, and if they entertained anywhere, this is where they brought their people. Like children were told, seen and not heard.
Where did you sleep, Beverly?
On the veranda out here. Do you like the doors and the windows? Funny shaped bedroom there with the funny shaped windows.
Yeah, oh.
Big up windows.
Sorry. A full length octagonal window leading out onto the veranda.
Yeah, and that's where I used to sleep up there. And Dad slept here and I slept up there. And those wrought iron beds.
Same beds?
Same beds. But I think it's in pretty good shape for over 113 years old. Yeah, I'm happy with what we've done now and where our family's gone, so, yeah.
You were the last woman standing almost.
Yeah, it was funny, I suppose. All the boys, all the green boys had girls. And I think that's when, in those days, girls didn't run businesses and girls didn't do things. That's where I thought my auntie was really good, because she ended up running here. And it proved that women can do those sort of things.
It's going full circle.
Yes, round circle. What you put into life is what you get out of it. I know it's hard, but it's what I enjoy. It's all I've known, so I hope I'm not too old to take it on board and see it all through.
And good luck to Beverly Pedrosini getting Prestwood back into shape. A good starting point for her and others living in many parts of Queensland would be a good soaking wet season to break the drought. Let's hope it comes soon. Thanks to Charlie McKillop for that report. You're listening to Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Next, we continue our special series on foreign investment in Australian agriculture.